restricting them from having bank accounts is absolutely insane, unfair, and unwise.
Congress looks at the intersection of state and federal marijuana laws for businesses. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists document a steep drop in the polar bear population in the Beaufort Sea.
If those rates were to persist long-term, the population would decline very rapidly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Begich has conceded the Alaska Senate race to Republican Dan Sullivan. Begich called Sullivan to congratulate him today. He said he urged Sullivan to adopt a bipartisan resolve in the Senate. Sullivan led the one-term incumbent Begich by about 8,100 votes on election night November 4th and maintained an edge as ballot counting continued. In a statement, Begich said he was proud of the work he accomplished in areas including energy development, veterans health care, and protecting postal service in Alaska. He said the state deserves a bright future with expanded economic opportunity and a strong, prosperous rural Alaska. He also said he supports equality for all Alaskans, and the results of an election have never diminished his desire to achieve these goals. The concession in the governor's race also came without ceremony. There was no press conference from the defeated Republican incumbent Sean Parnell. There also wasn't a victory press conference from unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker, who is currently on a short vacation in Hawaii. Instead, Parnell sent out an email to his supporters titled Honor of a Lifetime on Saturday evening. With nearly a 5,000 vote gap between him and Walker and just 10,000 absentee votes left to count, Parnell stated that his reelection was numerically possible, but highly improbable. The transition for a Walker administration began the same day. They now have access to state office space in Juneau and Anchorage and are beginning to form policy working groups on more than a dozen issues. Those working groups won't be in charge of personnel decisions. Bruce Botello is an advisor to the governor-elect and his running mate, Byron Mallott. He says logistical aspects of the transition are being handled by at least one member of Walker's incoming staff.
There is a small circle of advisors to Governor-elect Walker and Lieutenant Governor-elect Mallott, and that effort is largely being led by Jim Whitaker, who is the designated incoming chief of staff.
Whitaker, a moderate Republican, served as mayor of the Fairbanks North Star borough for 6 years. He also served 4 years in the legislature. The inauguration is scheduled for December 1st. With the passage of Prop 2 this month, Alaska joins Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and the District of Columbia in legalizing marijuana. While the state figures out how to regulate marijuana commerce, several federal laws sit as roadblocks to the business of cannabis. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Alaskans who hope to operate marijuana businesses will have to defy U.S. drug law, of course, but they'll also face other federal rules they're likely to find severely inconvenient and perhaps crippling to their enterprise. One problem is a bit of tax code called 280E. This provision, enacted in the 1980s, prevents narco-traffickers from deducting business expenses, and the IRS enforces it against state-licensed pot businesses, too. Taylor West, deputy director of the Denver-based National Cannabis Industry Association, says it means marijuana businesses can't deduct costs like rent and payroll when they file their tax returns.
What that results in is businesses paying an effective tax rate of somewhere around 70, 75, even 80% on their net profit.
It's crushing to small businesses, West says, even though a few legitimate deductions remain.
So Oddly enough, one of the things that a cannabis dispensary, for instance, can deduct is the cost of buying the marijuana.
Another big impediment for pot entrepreneurs is the banking rules. Banks typically refuse to allow marijuana businesses to open accounts out of fear they'll be implicated in money laundering or other federal crimes. West says some of the members of her industry trade association have found ways around it.
But the majority at this point are still having to operate entirely in cash and without the benefit of any sort of safety or accounting ease that comes from having a checking account.
Earl Blumenauer, a congressman from Oregon, says regardless of how you feel about legalizing marijuana, it's not a good idea to force these businesses out of the banking system.
Restricting them from having bank accounts is absolutely insane, unfair, and unwise if you care about money laundering, tax evasion, or just theft.
Blumenauer is pressing for a raft of bills that would ease federal restrictions on marijuana, but the most pressing are the tax code and the banking rules.
We need Congress to act on two serious problems that not just for those states that have legalized adult use, but for 23 states and counting that have legalized medical marijuana.
Blumenauer says a coalition of about 180 House Democrats and 50 Republicans supports liberalizing federal marijuana law. One of the most visible Republicans is Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California.
My message to my fellow Republicans is wake up and see where the American people are.
Rohrabacher from conservative Orange County says Republicans should join him to support principles like personal liberty and limited government, or just raw politics. Alaska Congressman Don Young is already on board. He co-sponsored a Rohrabacher bill to block federal prosecution of people who buy or sell marijuana in compliance with state laws. Spokesman Matt Shukarow says Young supports a state's right to determine the nature of criminal activity within its borders. But one of the biggest impediments to marijuana commerce may be congressional indifference. The leaders of both parties in the House and Senate haven't made federal marijuana reform a big priority. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
After a week without power, the lights in Tuluksak are back on. Peter Andrew is the tribal council president.
Well, it feels good, you know, power back on, and everybody's glad that they have their power back on, and most important thing was the freezer's getting cold.
Power was restored Friday. Some families lost hundreds of pounds of meat and fish due to the extended outage during unseasonably warm weather. The community of more than 400 located upriver from Bethel lost power earlier this month. The Alaska Energy Authority sent out an emergency generator after mechanics saw the community's existing units could not be fixed quickly. Emily Ford is the Energy Policy and Outreach Manager at the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is intended to be more of a short-term fix and not a long-term fix. So we were able to restore power to the community to serve that immediate need, but there will need to be some long-term solutions in order to replace and maintain existing infrastructure.
Andrew said he and the Tribal Council will have conversations with regional organizations about that long-term fix and whether they want to pursue becoming part of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists find a culprit for a sea star die-off from Mexico to Alaska.
Indeed, it is very peculiar to find a virus that is capable of infecting across such large numbers of species.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey are reporting a steep decline in the number of polar bears in the southern Beaufort Sea. In a study published today, they show the population dropped 40% in the first 10 years of this century. Between 2004 and 2007, out of 80 cubs the researchers observed, they only know of two that survived. Jeff Bromagen is a USGS researcher and lead author of the study. He says more cubs from that group may have survived, but the scientists didn't see them.
Of the 80 cubs that we captured and handled, we only ever recaptured two of them. So these bears weren't outfitted with electronics that we could track their every movement. It's just that a very small number of them were ever recaptured. And also during that period of time, we're seeing very few subadults in the bears that we catch. So evidence that the cubs are not living and surviving to get older.
What do these kinds of numbers mean for the population long term?
Well, survival rates that are that low for a animal like the polar bear that lives 20 to 30 years, it means that they're getting very little recruitment. You almost have to have a population decline with survival rates that are that low. And if those rates were to persist long term, the population would decline very rapidly.
Is there something that happened between 2004 and 2007 that was different or an anomaly that maybe impacted the polar bears in a way that you hadn't seen before?
That's certainly a possibility. There are several independent sources of information that suggest that survival during that period was low. For example, a Canadian study a couple years back found that the proportion of bears that were fasting in the spring or going without food was dramatically higher than it had been back in the 80s. Females with cubs, for example, I think their rate approximately doubled to 25% of the females with cubs were fasting. And that's at a time of the year when they should be eating seals and putting on weight.
Any idea of why that may have been happening?
No real direct evidence. You know, there are other lines of evidence that corroborate that kind of thing. One thing we did see several instances of polar bears clawing and chewing through really thick ice barriers to try to get at the seals. So a bit of evidence that the bears were hungry and nutritionally stressed.
And using more energy trying to get food than they would have otherwise.
Yes, chewing through that 10 or 12 inches of ice is quite energetically demanding.
Taking all of what you've observed, both between 2004 and 2007 and more broadly, what do you think is causing this decline?
Well, we really suspect it's climate-induced changes to the sea ice. The open water period in the summer and early fall is getting longer. 2012 was a new record low in the sea ice. And also the characteristics of the winter ice is changing. The remaining ice is much thinner than it used to be, and it's more susceptible to wind and wave action. It's creating some piled up, jumbled ice conditions in the near coast areas, for example, that may also limit access to seals.
Has there been any evidence that maybe the prey, the food, the seals, that's changing in conjunction with changes to the ice?
There's really not a lot of information on seals in that part of the world. There is a site in Canada, a bit east of our study area, that does monitor subsistence harvested seals. And during this period of time when we saw low survival, they were observing very low seal production as well. That again picked up in about the 2007 time frame. But we really don't have any evidence that what they're finding to the east is really applicable off the Alaskan coast.
Jeff Bromagen is a researcher with the U.S. Geological Survey. A mysterious illness causing mass die-offs of Pacific starfish has baffled scientists since the epidemic first started in the summer of 2013. But scientists now think they may be one step closer to an answer. A new study points to a virus as the likely cause of dwindling sea star numbers from Mexico to Alaska. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
If you're a starfish in the Pacific, sea star wasting disease is pretty much your zombie apocalypse. Marine microbiologist Ian Hewson has witnessed this firsthand in his research. The first symptom is arm curling.
The ends of their arms start to sort of flex upwards and they start to sort of detach from the rock surface.
Then they undergo a process called pretzeling.
So they basically fold themselves into a pretzel. They're almost as though they're tying themselves into a knot.
Next, the starfish lose some of their internal pressure and begin to deflate. And then lesions start to form.
Once the lesions appear, the animal begins to die.
The sea star's arms begin to fall off.
And then they undergo sort of this process of melting.
Up until recently, scientists didn't know what was causing mass starfish die-offs in the Pacific. Hewson is the lead author on a new study that identifies a particular virus as the likely cause of the current wasting disease outbreak. After observing how wasting disease spread in aquariums, Hewson and his team isolated the common thread, a virus they're calling sea star-associated densovirus. Sea star wasting epidemics are nothing new, but past incidences have been related to El Nino events, or warmer seawater. The current outbreak in the Pacific is different. It's startling for both its severity and its range, from Baja California all the way up to Alaska. Hewson guesses it's the largest marine epidemic biologists have ever seen, and it's still spreading farther south into Mexico and farther north.
The sea stars in Alaska have started to become really affected by this disease.
Earlier this year, there were just a handful of isolated reports of sea star wasting disease around Juneau and Sitka. Since then, it's been observed in Glacier Bay and as far north as Homer.
I have every expectation that it will move into sea star populations further along the Alaska coast, probably out into the Aleutians.
In Sitka, University of Alaska Southeast biology professor Marnie Chapman says the first reports of wasting disease came in from the harbor earlier this year. Sunflower stars were some of the first that people noticed being affected, Chapman says.
You can't look down at the harbors and find any right now.
The sunflower stars are giants in the world of starfish, as big as a family pizza.
It's very dramatic to see these big sunflower stars die. People use the term melting a lot. They just sort of turn into these piles of little tiny sea star bones, which are called ossicles.
Apart from its geographical breadth, what's also unique about this epidemic is how many different species of starfish are affected. At least 20, possibly more. Dr. Hewson again.
Indeed, it is very peculiar to find a virus that is capable of infecting across such large numbers of species.
Most viruses are host-specific, meaning they can only survive and proliferate in one kind of animal. But the virus Hewson identified, sea star-associated densovirus, or SSADV, is a remarkable generalist. It's even found across different groups of echinoderms, like urchins and brittle sea stars. And the story gets even weirder. Size appears to matter. Hewson found that smaller, juvenile sea stars, for example, can tolerate high viral loads without showing symptoms of wasting disease.
Whereas the adult sea stars, when they don't have the virus present, are perfectly fine and healthy. But when the larger sea stars have a much smaller number of viruses than the juveniles, but when they have the viruses present, they die.
As to why smaller sea stars seem to be immune or protected from the virus, that's still a mystery to Hewson and his colleagues. So, what's in the future for sea star wasting disease in Alaska?
You know, it's probably going to continue until it reaches a point where it's no longer, able to move around.
Viruses play an important ecological role in marine environments, Hewson says. The current epidemic of wasting disease is severe, true, but Hewson says this kind of die-off is cyclical.
No virus wipes out its host population entirely. There's never been an extinction as a result of a virus.
It's too early to tell how Pacific marine environments will change as a result of the outbreak, Hewson says. Sea stars are major predators, and in places where they've been wiped out, scientists are already seeing changes, notably in prey abundance, which has a ripple effect. What those changes will look like long term is still unclear. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Native elders are 5 times more likely to be injured in a fall, but there are simple ways for elders to reduce fall-related injuries. Get an eye exam every year. Stay informed about medications that can cause dizziness. Exercise regularly to increase strength and balance. Keep your home clutter-free. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
The Army's highest-ranking soldier in Alaska says the military trains here so it can operate in the Arctic, which he calls one of the world's most difficult environments. And Major General Mike Shields says it's becoming more complex with climate change. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Shields says the 12,000 U.S. Army Alaska soldiers under his command train here so they can fight and win at 60 below, and then board a giant C-17 transport and fly across the world to fight in a jungle or desert. That's a complex mission, and Shields says it's becoming more so with increased shipping and resource development in an Arctic that's becoming ice-free due to climate change, and the military buildup by nations vying to protect their growing interests in the region. He says it's like playing on a multidimensional chessboard.
I talk about, you know, three-dimensional chess or four-dimensional chess, and I think that's what we're playing. You know, we see what's going on with Russia. We see, you know, some of our Pacific neighbors, you know, vying for influence in the Arctic. We see some of the Arctic Council countries and others and how they're hedging and positioning and posturing and so forth. So it's a complex piece. And as the ice melts and potential economic shipping lanes open and so forth, it just becomes a bigger challenge.
Shields says more cargo and passenger ships are likely to be passing along Alaska's coasts in the years ahead, and he says that'll create more demand for humanitarian and disaster assistance from the military task force that includes U.S. Army Alaska. He cited the lessons learned from the Norwegian Navy and Coast Guard's recent rescue of 900 passengers aboard a cruise ship that hit sea ice and sank in the Arctic waters north of Europe.
900 people sounds like a lot, but when you take a look at some of the ships that are parked at Whittier, Seward, and how they could grow in the future to the thousands, I mean, how do you manage a disaster of that magnitude in the Arctic?
Shields gave his talk to a crowd on Thursday at the University of Alaska Fairbanks during UAF's Arctic Day 2014. The event was held to showcase the university's research programs in the region and its collaboration in those endeavors with academic and governmental partners. Shields says that research has helped the U.S. military and its allies and Arctic partners in many ways, including participation in a research program called the Arctic Collaborative Environment. It's operated in conjunction with the university's Arctic Region Supercomputing Center, and among other things, it tracks sea ice. The Supercomputing Center helps federal agencies operating in the Arctic, including Joint Task Force Alaska, or JTF Alaska, and the Undersecretary of Defense's Office of Acquisition of Technology and Logistics, or OSDATL. Shields says the university-military collaboration is helping agencies monitor activity in the region to attain a level of surveillance in the region known as all-domain awareness.
We work with the university, with the Arctic Collaborative Environment. It's in conjunction with NASA and OSD, ATNL. From a JTF Alaska perspective, we're looking at how do we get all domain awareness for the Arctic.
Shields says all domain awareness extends beyond the Arctic to space and cyberspace. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Federal Office of Surface Mining is criticizing a state agency's handling of permit extensions and renewals for the Wishbone Hill coal project near Palmer. The office is upholding a decision by the Department of Natural Resources to renew project permits for the operator, Usabelli Coal. But the federal agency says the state erred in never officially terminating the permits due to inaction by an earlier owner. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
In October, Usabelli Coal got the news. The state approved renewal of the Wishbone Hill mining permits, which allows Usabelli to operate the mine. This month, in a letter to the state's Coal Mining Regulatory Program Director, Russell Kirkham, the Federal Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement upholds the state's decision. But Robert C. Postal, who wrote the letter, points out the state's allowance of extensions of time and its failure to pull the permits because of inactivity at the mine site violate the coal mining regulatory program. Kirkham says he can't discuss the letter or its contents because the matter is under appeal. The trustees for Alaska legal firm is appealing Wishbone Hill's October permit approval. Trustee attorney Vicki Clark says, in her view, the permits are invalid, and until now, OSM had agreed with those who are challenging the permits.
The final decision was very recent, and it is a complete 180 from the original decision, and in our opinion, is inconsistent with the law.
According to Postal's letter, both the federal and the state coal regulatory programs require mining to start within 3 years of the issuance of a permit. If not, the permit becomes invalid. Reasonable extensions are allowed, but Postal says Wishbone Hills 2 permits were originally granted in 1991, but since then the mining operation changed owners twice, and DNR granted an extension only once in the 18 years between 1991 and 2010, when Usabelli began operations. Postal says the state erred not because it now allows Usabelli to mine, but because DNR never officially terminated the permits due to the earlier owner's inaction at the mine site. Postal says Usabelli is not at fault because the permits it was operating under in 2010 were never invalidated by the state. So in effect, Usabelli was operating legally. Lorelei Simon is Usabelli Coal's spokesperson.
We have maintained the legitimacy of these permits since day one. Usabelli acquired the leases and the permits to the Wishbone Hill project in 1997, and we have actively maintained them with a desire to further develop the Wishbone Hill coal mine.
But a number of conservation groups in the Matanuska Valley and the Chickaloon tribal government have been fighting the mine. Lisa Wade represents Chickaloon Village Traditional Council. Wade says the OSM's decision only highlights the fact that the state failed to pay attention.
If the state isn't managing a permit this closely, if they're not following their own rules at this stage, then if operations were to start, would they follow their own rules in ensuring the health and the safety of the community, which has changed dramatically since 1991 when the permits were first issued?
Wade says suburban homes are now in close proximity to the mine site, as is an elementary school run by the tribe. Postal says that neither federal nor Alaska coal regulations expressly state whether permit termination occurs automatically at the end of 3 years or whether administrative action is required. So he concludes the federal government cannot require Alaska to invalidate a permit simply because a permit holder misses the 3-year deadline. Postal says a permit does not terminate automatically. Rather, it remains valid until the regulating authority takes action to terminate it in clear and unequivocal language. Postal further states that Alaska's coal regulatory program managers need to be explicit and timely in issuing notice of termination to permit holders who do not meet the 3-year deadline. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Monica Goki and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Didn't quite catch that report. Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.